Our lesson today is based on chapter 5 of the testimony of St. John, was dubbed supporting material for mystical Christianity by John A. Sanford. Although, frankly, I thought the supporting material on this chapter wasn't very supportive. That is, it didn't really have much insight into what the chapter was really getting into. But, who knows? Maybe I'll draw on it more than I think I will. This chapter starts out with the account of a healing. Jesus comes up to a pool of water in Jerusalem where people go who are in need of healing. And around it there are these covered areas that they're called porches, and people would wait on those, and every so often the water would be stirred up for no apparent reason. Now, the story was that an angel would come down and stir up the water, and that whoever went in first after that would be healed of whatever his need was. It may be that the angel was more in the form of some sort of underground thermal thing, but it doesn't matter. Point is, people went in and they would come out healed if they were the first ones in and the others wouldn't, which probably tells us a lot about healing, not about pools. But we'll get to that. The point that I want to get to in the preface is that immediately following this account of the healing and the controversy that it raised between Jesus and the sectarians who more or less controlled things in Jerusalem, it goes into a long discourse by Jesus on metaphysical things. Now, that's the same pattern we've seen in various of the chapters of the testimony of St. John. It's a very common pattern. And our text suggested, with what I would think was some reason, that probably Jesus didn't deliver each of these long discourses right after these events, but that they represent the sorts of things Jesus was teaching, and that these events brought them to mind in the mind of the person who's writing the account, and he puts them down as he remembers them. So what we find throughout the testimony of St. John is there'll be an experience, and then it'll be followed by this long discourse by Jesus on principles. And if you weren't thinking in terms of these being connected, you might not even realize there is a direct correlation between the event and the discourse. But if you really look at it closely in terms of principle, you see that the event is always a jumping off place for principles. And we'll kind of look at that as we go along. Well, the story starts out at a pool which is called in the Hebrew Bethesda. Some Orthodox Bibles have another name for it. Forgot exactly what it is. Doesn't matter, because I don't think it fits in as well. So that's why I don't remember it. But Bethesda means house of mercy. And this story is about divine mercy in healing. Not just in healing the person who gets first in the water, because that seems to be kind of limited mercy to me. But in terms of taking this man we're going to talk about and bringing him from a place of darkness and confusion and dependency to a place where he is healed of that, where he's able to take control of his life. And it was done not because of anything he did, not even because of his asking. It was basically an act of mercy. It was done in response to his need. And this is the basic principle, that light flows from a point of greater concentration to a point of lesser concentration. In other words, it flows to a place of need. I've even been in healing circles where people have put their hands on someone to let healing power flow into him, and you could actually feel the light go into the person, right out of the person into someone in the circle, because this person had the greater need. It's like water. It flows to the place where it isn't. So anyway, this is the house of mercy where this pool is. And around the pool, it says, are invalids who are blind, paralyzed, or otherwise handicapped, waiting for the water to be agitated. It is believed that the agitation of the water is caused by an angel. So even the person writing the testimony of St. John was a little skeptical about that. says it's believed that the agitation of the water is caused by an angel. Because really, what kind of an angel is it who has time to just periodically go down and stir up some water? And whoever first steps into the pool after it is agitated will be healed of his handicap, whatever it may be. Now that part, he didn't necessarily say that that's just believed. That apparently happened. Well, it is a fact that a goodly portion of healing is psychological. I was reading not too long ago in the New York Times that again, they did tests. It's very hard for scientifically minded people to accept this result, so they always keep redoing this test. They did tests between giving people a drug of some kind for healing an ailment. Half of them get this, the other half get essentially a sugar pill. Get something that should have no effect. About 60% of the people who got the pill that should have done nothing were healed. That's a really big figure. It's because in their minds they were receiving something for healing, so their minds were able to focus on the fact they were healed, and they were healed. They were being healed by faith. In this case, faith in a pill. You can be healed by faith in any of various things. People go to Lourdes in France to be healed by water, just like here. They'll be healed by the water. And a large percentage are healed. Because, not because the water is magical, but because their faith in the water allows their minds to work in them and change whatever the problem is. And so they heal. So this was happening at this pool in Jerusalem. Now let's look at it on another level. Pool means water. And water, psychologically, is usually the unconscious. The angel, which is an emanation of the divine, agitates the water of the unconscious. And when it does, healing tends to happen. That is, life can come out of the unconscious, and healing happens in our souls. And the important healing is not physical healing, but psychological and spiritual healing. And this comes out of the unconscious, which is the water. So we can read this myth on a physical level. That healing happens when we focus our faith in something. Or we can read it on a metaphysical level, that healing happens to us psychologically and spiritually when the unconscious starts getting roiled. And so we do a lot of things with meditation and other things to get the unconscious moving in us. That is, in terms of our consciousness. The unconscious doesn't have a problem with moving, but we have to consciously let it be a reality to us. And then it can start tossing up waves onto the shore of our consciousness so that things start happening in us that are beyond reason. Reason is limited to the ego. The unconscious is not reasonable. And it does all kinds of things that aren't reasonable. And when we like those things, we call them miracles. When we don't like them, we call them by other names. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean they're not good for us either. We want the kind of conscious to get agitated so that things can start happening in us. And those things will include healing, which every mortal soul needs. Well, in our myth, Jesus chooses someone waiting at the pool to be healed. Now, there's no indication of why he chose this person, really. And unless it was because he expected the responses that he got and they gave him a good teaching. There's nothing about this person that would indicate that he was ready to be healed as opposed to someone else. In fact, the indications are that he wasn't ready to be healed. Because Jesus asked him specifically, "Do you intend to be healed?" Now, in Orthodox Bibles, it says, "Do you want to be healed?" But the original Greek doesn't just say, "Do you want to be?" It's a much stronger word. It's, "Do you intend to be healed? Is that what you're here for?" The text tells us that the man's been coming for 30-odd years to this pool where supposedly people get healed. And he hasn't been healed. Jesus is asking him a question to heighten his awareness of what's going on. Is it your intention to be healed? Or are you, truthfully, get right down to it, comfortable in your limitations? Now, that's the orthodox mindset, is to be comfortable in the limitations and the boundaries, the limits that are set around you. And this man is definitely representing an orthodox mindset, because the one thing we are pulling out of this is he is, in fact, comfortable where he's at. And he isn't really looking for healing. He wants to have the appearance of looking for healing, because that's the appropriate thing to do in public opinion. And he's concerned, and in his own opinion, perhaps. But deep down, he's afraid of healing. He knows how to be an invalid. He doesn't know how to be a healed person, a whole person. So he really isn't intending to be healed. He's just intending to go through the motions without being healed. And that's what Jesus is perceiving. Sir, replied the invalid, there is no one to help me into the pool where the water is agitated. So while I'm on my way, someone else always steps in ahead of me. The classic victim response. I can't be healed. I'm stuck where I am. Poor me. And you should help me, because, but if nothing helped me to heal, help me, because I can't be healed. The focus of his reply is all on the negative rather than the positive opportunity that's being offered him. Jesus, in asking, do you intend to be healed, is giving the man the opportunity to say, yes, that's my intention. But he doesn't even catch it. Probably he's hearing Jesus say, do you want to be healed? Like he would expect him to say. And he's saying, of course I want to be healed, but I can't be. So you should help me. I do this for money or something. He's missing the whole point. Well, Jesus doesn't tend to play around. And you might not have even liked Jesus if you had encountered him, unless you had gotten to a Gnostic mindset, because he just said it the way it was. And what he said to the man was not, oh, I'm so sorry that you can't be healed. Is there anything I can do for you? He said, stand up. Probably just about like that. Stand up, Jesus instructed the man. The verb chosen is instructed. He didn't say, well, would you like to stand up? He didn't invite him to stand up. He told him, stand up. Pick up your litter and walk away. Later the man was carried there, probably by family, and then they came back and got him in the evening. Jesus said, enough of that. Just pick it up and walk away. And the man immediately was healed. Jesus cut through the illusions that led him to believe that he wasn't healed. And even though the man probably still wanted to be unhealed, the reality was he was healed and he knew it. He didn't have that cushion to fall back on anymore. The illusions were shattered. He perceived his reality, which was that he was able to walk just as well as anyone else. And so he did. Jesus vanished into the crowd, but later he found the man in the temple. Now, for whatever reasons, and the scriptures say a number of times that Jesus didn't want to draw attention to himself through the miracles he performed. He might perform them in order to help a certain person break through, but he wasn't trying to draw attention to himself for that. And Jesus himself said to the people, you're just coming because you've heard about the miracles. That isn't why I want you to come. So once he'd done this, he just got lost in the crowd. But later, finding the man in the temple, he said to him, you have been healed this time. Don't continue living a life centered in the illusion of separateness, or something worse may happen to you. Not putting a curse on him, but simply saying, if you keep seeing yourself as separate from the whole and seeing yourself as subject to these kinds of things, then your mind is going to be open for something else to put you down, to put you in a secure but helpless place. You've got to get over that illusion of separateness if that's not going to happen. So the negatives in our lives result from our being subject to illusions. And as long as we're living out there in the illusions instead of in the reality of the hyperconscious, these things will keep happening to us. Bad things happen to good people a lot. But they don't happen, using good in the conventional sense of what I'm telling the book, of course, but they don't keep happening to us as we become enlightened. It's not that nothing bad can ever happen, but we are not victims anymore. And when negative things do come into our lives, we look for the principles that enable us to get on top of them and go on and leave them behind. We don't become victims and let them just continue to rule us. That's what Jesus is trying to tell this man. Leaving the temple, the man reported to his inquisitors. That is, after he was healed, some of the Pharisees had seen him carrying his litter, and they stopped him. They said, "You shouldn't be doing that." And he said, "Well, the man who healed me told me to do it." His thinking being, perhaps, that the man had enough power to heal him, he should be able to tell him what to do and do it, regardless of the rules. And so they wanted to know who the man was, and he couldn't tell them because Jesus had just melted into the crowd. He didn't know who he was. But now, he's talked to him in the temple, he knows who he is. He goes back to them and says that it was Jesus who had healed him, because our text says, because he didn't realize their hatred for Jesus. Now, in mystical Christianity, he goes to great lengths to indicate that there's something warped in this man, that he would tell them that it was Jesus, when Jesus had in fact benefited him. But there's no indication in our text that that was the case. The man's still operating in ignorance. Ignorance of human nature, ignorance of the nature of these, of orthodox nature for sure, and what these people stood for in opposition to Jesus, but not any ill will or any inappropriate desires there except naivete. He just didn't seem to yet understand light and darkness and how they were working in people. However, this was not the case with these Pharisees. They were hating Jesus because he stood for gnosis. He stood for the breaking down of all their rules of life, which they wanted to impose on others. He said to a group of them once, "You go all over the world looking for converts. And then when you get them, you make them 10 times more the children of hell than they were before." That is, you keep lock them into darkness by all your rules, so that they aren't growing into their divine potential. So they, between the Pharisees and the other sectarians, the Orthodox sectarians of Jesus, there was this metaphysical battle going on. So when they heard that it was Jesus who healed the man, they increased their persecution of Jesus, seeking to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath, which was one of their biggest rules. Can't do anything on the Sabbath, didn't matter whether it was good or bad. Their rule is, to this day, that if you do not live within walking distance of the synagogue, then you should stay home on the Sabbath, because to use any kind of a vehicle is violating the Sabbath. Better not to go than to get there by anything that breaks the rules. Now, in my mind, it's hard to see how driving a car is more work than walking. But the rules are the rules. And that's the place they're coming from. Well, it's the nature of mortal mind to be nitpicking, is what it comes down to. Instead of perceiving the miracle of the healing, they're arguing over whether the man had a right to pick up the pallet of the mind on and walk with it. See, the one thing is totally inconsequential, but that's what mortal mind tends to make big. The other thing, which is tremendous, mortal mind tends to ignore. That's really the nature of it. When the Pharisees accused him for healing on the Sabbath day, Jesus replied, "My father and mother have worked until now, and I am continuing their work." This is a key thing in the discourse that follows. This is the transition. The fact that he spoke of the divine as his father and mother, and said that he is continuing their work, thereby making himself their heir, is what really riles the Pharisees. They weren't really going to kill him because he broke the Sabbath. They didn't like it. They would fight against him. But they want him destroyed because he claims a relationship to the divine that is beyond theirs. It says they were. Then they were even more determined to kill him because he had not only violated the Sabbath in their view, but they also felt that by calling the divine his father and mother, he was claiming to be equal with deity, which is true, in that we are what our parents were. That's where we start out. Now, we may make ourselves into something quite different, but if I say my parents were wealthy, the implication is that I may be too. If I say my parents are divine, the implication is that I may be too. This is the thing they absolutely could not accept, that Jesus was claiming to divine. And however, as we go on, we'll see why it's a reasonable claim to make. Not to mortal mind, represented by the Pharisees, but to anyone who will look at reality. So then Jesus explained, I tell you the truth when I say that the Son can do nothing by himself. One evidence that we are probably getting a summation of a discourse Jesus gave and not Jesus' own words would be that if he had spoken that way, they probably would have had no idea what he's talking about. The concept didn't really fit in the whole Jewish worldview of speaking. The Son can do nothing by himself. Who is the Son? It wasn't clear then. It was clear to the Christian community who was getting the scripture, it's clear to us. And Jesus may have spoken of principles like this to a group of Pharisees, or he may have spoken about to his disciples, and it's being put here in the story because it fits, in a context that works, or there may be, as many Gnostic teachings were, things that Jesus delivered after his resurrection, but projected back onto his life to make it work for us. It doesn't matter. But I tell you the truth when I say that the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he has seen the Father and Mother do. But the Son will do everything the Father and Mother have previously done. For the Father and Mother love the Son and have shown him everything they have done. And he's talking here about what happens in us psychologically in our development to become divine. And so when he said that he was divine, he was really speaking for every one of us in our potential. Because Jesus is the representative of human perfection, of all we can be. So when he says something about himself, he's also saying it about us, potentially, if we develop to be what he represents. So the parents are the archetype of wholeness. And they show us what to do to become whole ourselves. In other words, if we keep the parents in front of us, the image of the parents in front of us, and we look at the difference between that image and what we are, we know what we have to do to become divine. We have to change those differences. So the whole process we have to follow is within us already, in the hyperconscious where the parent archetypes reside. So Jesus, if we go back and look at what he said now, in terms of ourselves, I tell you the truth when I say that the Son, that's you and me, doesn't matter if you're male or female, because we all know that male and female are part of the difference between us and the divine. The divine is neither male nor female, it's whole. So, the Son applies to all of us. The Son can do nothing by himself. You can't transcend mortal limitations by yourself. You can only do what you have seen the Father and Mother do. When you encounter these archetypes of wholeness within yourself and you perceive what they are able to do, then you know what you can do, potentially. But the Son will do everything the Father and Mother have previously done. That is, and of course you're only a son if you develop that relationship with the Divine. Thereby you know that you are a child of the Divine and that you are growing into the image of your parents, which is what children do. For the Father and Mother love the Son. The Divine loves you as an emanation of the Divine. And they have shown him everything they have done. That's what archetypes are for. They show us realities that consciously we couldn't discover for ourselves. So he's putting the Pharisees' objection to his divinity, manifest in this healing, into the context of showing us our own divine potential. In fact, they, the parents, are going to show him greater things than these, things which your minds would be unable to perceive if they were shown to you. That is greater things than a healing. Just healing someone who hasn't been able to walk, so he get up and carry his pallet and break the Sabbath day. That's not the big thing. And I say break the Sabbath day from the Pharisees' point of view. He's saying this is nothing compared to what the parents are going to show us, which is how to be everything the parents are, how to be divine. That's the big thing. That's what the parents will show. But if they showed it to you Pharisees, who are worshippers of the demiurge, for whom the conscious mind is the all, who can't see beyond the systems you set up with your conscious minds, if they showed these things to you, you wouldn't even see them anymore. That is, nothing can come to consciousness that we're not open to let come to consciousness. That's why an important part of our development is the rechanneling of our brains so that thoughts can flow in new directions that where they've never flowed before. Because otherwise we can't perceive these realities that are coming out of the unconscious that are totally of a different nature than our conscious perceptions and thoughts. They are of the divine nature. Our conscious perceptions and thoughts are of the mortal nature. It has to be a bridging habit. It has to be a change happening in order for us to perceive these things. That's why we speak of putting on the mind of Christ, a mind that can see differently, think differently, perceive differently than the mortal mind. So, this extends to individuation. It extends to visions that go beyond individuation, which is, after all, only a milestone in the journey of eternal progression. And we have to be able to open up to all of this. Words can't convey it because words are limited to mortal consciousness. We have to be able to get beyond the words to experience the reality of what is beyond. For one thing, Jesus says, just as the father and mother can raise those who have died, bringing them back to life again, the Son will also bring back to life those whom he chooses. Now, in our text, life is a capital L. I don't know that it did in Greek. I don't know how capitals work in Greek. I know there are none in Hebrew. But life with a capital L is metaphysical. It's metaphysical life. And I guess we could have put a capital D on death here, because it's metaphysical death we're talking about, though we don't ever do that. We only capitalize the right half of the picture, the light half, the half that we identify with. Jesus is talking about metaphysical death and life. The parents can raise those who have died metaphysically, that is, those who aren't alive, in fact. Their birth was a death. And they have not come back to life. And that's true of every mortal. Everybody has to be born again from above. And the parents can make that happen in anyone. The father and mother are not going to evaluate any of mankind. They have given that responsibility to the Son, so that everyone who honors the father and mother will honor him. A person who refuses to honor the Son dishonors the father and mother who sent him. Now, wait a minute. Who is the Son? We've already established the Son is the seeker, the person on the quest, the person who has established a relationship with the divine architects, but has not yet completed deification. The Son archetype is the archetype of our potential, the transition to the divine. So, what's evaluating us is not the divine archetypes, who are so far above what we are that it would be difficult for them to evaluate. It would, not that they couldn't, but that it would be difficult for us to accept an evaluation. But the Son is ourselves. In other words, we, if we are in the way of gnosis, continually evaluate ourselves against the divine archetypes and see how we need to change to go into that. That's what's required of us. So there's no one up there saying, you must do this and you must do that. Except that this saying, you must evaluate yourself and see what's necessary to become divine. I tell you truly, everyone who responds to hearing my word by believing in those who sent me will receive everlasting life or divine life. They will not be condemned because they will have been removed from the realm of death and able to enter the realm of life. And who will have been? Those who respond to hearing the word by believing in those who sent the Son, by believing in the divine parents, by believing, therefore, in our divine potential. If you believe in the divine parents, you must believe that we have the potential to be divine, because we are children of the divine. That faith will lead you to grow into that divinity or into divine life. It's a very simple process he's talking about. That means you will be removed from the realm of death, which is the mortal condition, and able to enter the realm of life, which is the divine condition. In fact, he says, the time is almost here when those who have died will hear the voice of the Son of the Elohim, and those who will listen to him will live again. He's foreshadowing here a move forward in consciousness for the human race. It did happen as a result of Jesus' ministry. A time when those who have died, which was the whole human race, would hear the voice of the Son of the Elohim. But he says those who will listen to him, he didn't say those who hear the voice, because that's the whole human race. But those who listen to him will live again. That is, the individual still has to listen to him in order to extend from the death of the mortal condition to the life of the divine condition. So Jesus brought a step forward in consciousness to the human race. It wasn't the last one, it wasn't the first one, but it was the most important. That opened up our divine potential beyond what it had ever been before as a body, rather than just as a few individuals. But every individual still has to listen to the divine voice, which is more accessible than it was, but no less automatic. I mean, no more. It's just as unautomatic as it always is. We have to listen and let it happen in us. Just as the Father has life in himself, so has the Son inherited from him life in himself, and has received from the Father and Mother authority to evaluate those who have died, because he is the Son of Man, the Son of Divine Anthropos, right? Meaning, therefore, that he has inherited that which those attributes which pertain to Divine Anthropos. The Son carries the nature of the parents to humans. And so he carries the possibility of divine life to us, because that is the nature of the parents, divine life. Because he is the Son of Man. Because he conveys divine anthropos to us. Do you find this amazing? Jesus asked. And people do, don't they? People in Master Modern Mind do find it amazing, but mostly they just can't even believe it. But he says, I tell you truly, the time is coming when everyone who is in the grave will hear the voice of the Son of Man and will come out of their graves. What's the grave? The mortal condition. Everyone trapped in the mortal condition is dead. One Gnostic master said that most people are living at a poor dying rate, meaning that they get more deeper and deeper into death. But they start out in it too. It just gets more and more intense as they go along. They're not rising to life, they're going deeper into death. But the time is coming when every one of them will hear the voice of the Son of Man and will come out of the mortal condition one way or another. Now we understand that. Everyone's going to rise to some realm of light, except those who choose a realm of darkness. And even then, they're not staying in the mortal condition. They're going into a different realm. Those who ascended their lives in propriety will come up in the resurrection of the justified. That is, their lives will be justified by the fact that through living with propriety, they have grown to the point that they can be redeemed, they can be lifted out of darkness, they can be lifted to a higher life, which we call resurrection. while those who have centered their lives in impropriety will come up in the resurrection of the unjustified. They too will be lifted to life, but it will be a different light, and it will be a harder process because they have not developed that sense of propriety that allows them to make the right choices for being lifted up. But all of them will be evaluated by the Son of Man. Still, the Son of Divine Anthropos. He's being very archetypal in what he's saying because he wants us to know that that's what we're dealing with. For my evaluation will be just, because I will evaluate according to the principles which I have been taught by my father and mother. Continuing that concept of evaluation that we've already discussed. I don't claim to do this on my own authority, for I don't act according to my own preferences. But I do as I am instructed by the father and mother who sent me. Now he's saying there an example for us that if we are to go through this process and be deified, we have to do it according to the instructions of the father and mother who know how to do it. We can't do it on the basis of our own preferences. Now, it's okay to be creative. If you're cooking, you can make up your own recipe if you want to, but the odds are that it may turn out to be awful. If you follow a recipe that's known to work, you have a pretty good likelihood that it's going to be good. If you follow it exactly, it's almost certain to be good. And that's what Jesus is saying about eternal life. We grow into our divine potential if we follow the way that the Father and Mother have given through the Son. If we follow our own preferences, we probably are not going to perfectly accomplish that. Maybe better, maybe worse, but we're probably going to fall short because we don't know enough to be able to make all the right decisions. You may reproach me because I am my own witness. That is he saying, okay, I'm telling you all this, and what you want to say to me is, well, who are you? You're just telling us this. You're the only witness of this. Why should we accept what you say? But, he says, my witness is true. That's number one. Number one, the fact that what he's saying is true is the important thing. He doesn't need 1,000 people to say it's true. It is true, and therefore it speaks for itself. The principles of Gnosis speak for themselves. When people are open, seeking, and listening, and they hear the principles of Gnosis, the principles speak to them, and they realize they do. They speak with a familiar spirit, Isaiah said. They sound right. Maybe not every principle sounds right as you go along. Right? We know that. Some principles we have to wrestle with and so forth. But the general message of Gnosis sounds right. We recognize it. This is the reality. Well, that's number one. But he says, nor am I the only witness to the truth of my teachings, for there is another who bears witness of me. And I know that the testimony which she bears concerning me is true. Second witness is Sophia, the testator, the comforter, who also bears testimony. First of all, the message itself speaks truth. It rings true. Secondly, the Spirit is saying to you, this is true. And then, on top of that, because two witnesses are good, but three are even better, you also sent representatives to John to ask him concerning me, and he testified of the truth that I unfold. That is, those who have been through the process of Gnosis, whom it has transformed, who have mastered Gnosis, they also testify that this works. So we have the testimony of the principles, we have the testimony of the Spirit, and we have the physical testimony of those who have experienced it and know for themselves. We have three witnesses to the principles that Jesus has outlined for transforming us into the divine. John did not receive his testimony from another mortal, says Jesus, but he received it from the Elohim. You yourselves say that John is a prophet, so you are to accept his testimony. I am telling you these things so that you can be saved from the false traditions and concepts which bind you down so that you cannot accept truth. speaking there of the Orthodox mindset, right? Traditions and concepts handed down to box you in so that you can't accept truth. Because truth conflicts with these systems that are built up. It's very natural to want to build systems. When I was young, that's what I wanted to do with the good news, is systematize it. Make it so you just knew exactly what it was saying. But this doesn't work. You lose the whole message there. Those who accept systems want to bind down everyone else so that it will all be in the system. But that keeps us from going where we could go. Keeps us from being what we could be. But the message of Christ is that you can be saved from all this. That you can be led from where you are, enmeshed in mortal mind, to where you want to be. Enmeshed only in divine light, which is not being enmeshed at all. I have a greater witness than the testimony of John, Jesus says. For when I do the works which the Father and Mother have given me to do, those works testify that the Father and Mother have sent me. And what work did the Father and Mother give him to do? To impart gnosis so that mortals could be freed from all these false systems. And when a person accepts the principles of gnosis from him, they are, that person is free. And that's the biggest testimony of all. A system that works, works. You can't argue with success. If you're freed by gnosis, it works. If others tell you they've been freed from gnosis, that's a powerful testimony that's worth looking into. If you look at the difference between the results of gnosis and the results of belief systems that box you in with rules, that's a powerful testimony to gnosis. In fact, the Father and Mother who sent me have borne witness of me. I tell you the truth when I testify to you that you have never heard the voice of the Father and Mother, nor have you seen them. For their word doesn't dwell in you, and you don't believe him whom they have sent. Mortal mind cannot hear the Father. Now, it's true, the parents are remote. They are brought close by Christ. But they're remote from mortal mind, not because they choose to be, but because mortal mind has set barriers that they cannot penetrate unless we let the Son, the archetype of the Son, penetrate from within and open us up so that the Father and Mother can come through. So to these people who were locked into the mortal mindset, whose greatest conception of deity was the demiurge, Jesus could say, you never heard the voice of the Father and Mother. It would be impossible. They couldn't hear it. And they couldn't have seen them. They were too far removed from them. Unless they would accept the Son who could open them up, then there's no way that they ever could experience the Father and Mother. Search those scriptures which you believe contain the keys to eternal life. If you study them with your minds open to receive life, you will find that they testify of me. Any scriptures, he's saying. We have our Orthodox Christians, that's the Bible, and only the Bible, right? Fine. Tell them. Search that Bible, but look for what it really says. Don't just believe what some television preacher tells you it says. Or anyone else. If you take that Bible and you really dig into it, it will show you keys for eternal life. They'll end up being Gnostic keys of Gnosis. If the person you're talking to is a Muslim, let him search the Quran. It can do the same thing. No book that millions of people turn to for spiritual guidance is devoid of keys of truth. They usually miss them because they've got Orthodox teachers telling them how to interpret the book. But if they'll get into their book that they consider to be scripture, whether it be Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, or any other, they will find keys that will point them to Gnosis, and through Gnosis to eternal life. but they've got to stop reading in the Orthodox way. I know how it is to read the scriptures in the Orthodox way. I've watched that. I did it myself at one time, and I've watched others do it. You take the book and you read along, and then you get to a sentence that's quoted all the time by Orthodox leaders, and you say, "Oh, isn't that wonderful?" And then you go back to, and then you hit another sentence that you've heard that's one of your key sentences among your Orthodox teachers, and you say, "Oh, that's so wonderful." You're not reading the scriptures. You're just reaffirming what you've heard from somebody. But if you read each sentence and dig out what it's saying, you will find keys to Gnosis. And any scripture that you can pick up, and almost any book you can pick up, if it's got any real purpose in terms of enlightenment behind it. I know you, speaking again to those who are enmeshed in mortal mind. I know you, and I know that divine love is not in you. Of course, that's a key. The love, it's divine love, true love, is put forth in the scriptures as the manifestation of the divine. But in them, there's just criticism and condemnation, not divine love, which is good evidence that they're not hooked into the divine. Divine love is not in mortal nature. So it's mortal nature that Jesus knows in this case, and these Pharisees are the personification of mortal nature, and therefore not hooked into divine reality or divine love. I have come as a representative of my father and mother, but you will not accept me. If someone else were to come, claiming to represent no one but himself, you would accept him. Now there's a key statement in terms of the Demiurge. The Demiurge represents only himself. I am God, and there is no other, the Demiurge says. And yet the Demiurge is just mortal mind blown up. If someone comes and says, "I am God, there is no other, it's just it's I, people will follow that one. He says, "I come to unfold the unknown God. I have come to show you the divinity within yourself." People are not even hearing it. There's not an I there. It's a little I instead of a big I. A mortal mind doesn't respond. Of course, there is no way that you could accept me, because you desire to be honored by other mortals, when I can offer you only that honor which comes from the Elohim. For other mortals will despise you if you follow my way. Still, see, he's saying, you are caught in ego-centeredness. With you, it's all I. You have to have other people saying how good you are. And they don't say that about Gnostics, generally speaking. Not an issue whether Gnostics are good or not, it's just they don't meet the definitions of mortal mind. If what you want is for everyone to think well of you, don't bother seeking Gnosis, because you aren't going to stay with it. And people will not particularly think well of you because of it. They will in some cases, maybe, when their mind happens, their eyes happen to be opened by a circumstance that they can't refute, but it, in general, won't last. Because you're not following the way of the Demiurge in your mind. Don't think that I'm going to accuse you before the father and mother. Now, he's just accused them before themselves. That's an effort to help them awaken to their own state. But don't think that I'm going to accuse you before the father and mother. It is Moses, whom you trust to lead you to salvation, who will accuse you. Had you really believed what Moses said, you would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But since you don't really believe what Moses wrote, even though you claim to follow his teachings, how could you possibly believe what I say? And that is the Orthodox dilemma. They have a book. All the Bible. Sure, it means books. But anyway, they have a collection of books called the Bible. They claim that this is their source of knowledge of the divine. They claim that this book is what they follow, and that they follow the people who wrote this book. But in fact, they don't follow that book. The Bible is a fine book. I think Mark Twain was the one who said, "The Bible is a fine book. It would be a wonderful book if anyone ever lived by it." But no one does. So they've got the book, they claim the book, but in fact the very people who wrote the book would condemn where they stand. Because the people who wrote most of the books that are in the Bible were Gnostics. They had risen above the mortal condition and were trying to shed some light back on it. They were not standing for the mortal mindset. Now there are some exceptions for two reasons. Sometimes to meet the needs of mortal mind, there are things that are there, and sometimes there are things that are just included that really never did get above mortal mind. But on the whole, the very book they claim to reverence stands against the very things that they're standing for. It isn't going to uphold them. So, what they don't need to worry about the Gnostics saying that they're wrong. Their own scriptures say that this is the wrong mindset, and that they need to rise above it to the parental archetypes revealed through Jesus Christ. Because actually, finally, entering into communication with those archetypes gives us the means to be transformed, to become like them. Not instantly, but it opens up the path through which that transformation can take place. And that was the whole purpose of the descent of the Redeemer in the first place. It is for that that he came, and it was the accomplishment of that that justified his life in ministry. And it is our accepting it that justifies us in relation